The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Major League Baseball moves the All-Star Game.
The problem is the President of the United States, Joe Biden, is leading the irrational forces here.
And the rhetoric contradicts President Biden's call for unity.
When you use the words Jim Crow to describe something like this, you're setting the raging fire. You're the arsonist.
We'll look at the voting laws that led to the controversy.
There's no evidence in the analyzed data that voter laws have a statistically significant impact on voter turnout.
And later, the Derek Chauvin trial and the murder of George Floyd.
The guy had no pulse and was not breathing for the last 4.5 minutes. And even a minute after the ambulance showed up, he kept his knee on the guy's neck.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. Leave it to the Democrats to find a way to unite all Republicans. The state of Georgia reformed their voting laws. The criticism from Democrats was harsh, and in the case of President Joe Biden, simply not true. President Biden encouraged Major League Baseball to punish Georgia by removing the upcoming All-Star Game from Atlanta, and it did, moving the game to Colorado, which has similar voting laws to Georgia. This is one time when all conservative and Republican voices are speaking as one, outraged by the hypocrisy of this moment. Georgia's voting laws are now similar to those of many blue states. The effort to paint the reform as racist is a step too far, a mile too far, even by the standards of current Democratic leadership. I spoke this week to Chris Christie, former governor of New Jersey.
To me, the real blame, and I'm not trying to say that, you know, whether Coke or Delta or Major League Baseball shouldn't have taken the time to read the bill and make their own decision. But, this comes down to the President of the United States being out there and saying things that are just absolutely outright false. And to call this law Jim Crow is just outrageous when you look at exactly what the law says. And that's what I think we need to focus on most particularly is what did Georgia do and what does it mean for voting? And that's the most important thing. And what's being done out there, mischaracterized by everybody from Joe Biden to Stacey Abrams to every other Democrat who has a soapbox, is just wrong.
Well, you know, if it was Jim Crow, it would be unconstitutional, and rightly so. If they had passed a law that in any way was based upon an intent to harm people of any minority or on gender or on religion, it would be unconstitutional. It's a voting regulation, and I think it's necessary because I believe in voting ID. When did that become voting suppression, Governor Christie?
Yeah, I don't know, especially because in Joe Biden's own state of Delaware, as you know, they've required voter ID for as long as Joe Biden's been seeking office in that state. And, the requiring a voter ID just makes sense. I mean, for goodness sake, Hugh, you know, if you get on an airplane today, you have to show ID. If I go to get into an office building in New York City today, I have to show ID. Yet I don't have to show ID to execute electing people to power in this country. Just makes no sense. And by the way, as you know, what they did in the Georgia laws was to expand what people could use as ID. So even though 97% of the people who voted in Georgia have a driver's license, they also said that we'll give you a state ID card for free if you don't have a driver's license, or you can use a utility bill, or you can use the last 4 digits of your social security number. I mean, this is not onerous, and it certainly is not racist in any way.
So do you believe President Biden has knowledge that what he is saying is false when he says it?
Yes.
And so Do you think he is doing so with the intent of increasing Democratic Party attachment in the African-American community?
Yes.
You see, go ahead.
I think he's dividing the country. He wants purpose for his own political advantage right now. And it's sad to say it. You know, I listened to the president's inaugural address. I sat there that day at ABC and listened to it. And I think it's important for people to hear these words.
Politics doesn't have to be a raging fire, destroying everything in its path. Every disagreement doesn't have to be a cause for total war. And we must reject the culture in which facts themselves are manipulated and even manufactured.
Well, if that doesn't describe exactly what he has done, when you use the words Jim Crow to describe something like this, you're setting the raging fire. You're the arsonist.
That's absolutely right. CNN today has a story that says Texas could be the next front in voter suppression laws. That's not a story. That's a piece of advocacy. It's not voting suppression. It is voting security and vote. I want the Israeli system. You have to go home and you have to like throw five pieces of ID and you're not allowed to vote. There are no absentees. I want the Israeli system.
Well, and think about this, the hypocrisy also of Stacey Abrams in all this. She was celebrating last week here in New Jersey, the new law that was signed that allows 9 days of early voting and saying it was one of the best laws in the country. When Georgia allows 17 days of early voting and up to 19 days if you use the two optional Sundays. I mean, are you kidding me? That's Jim Crow. But, you know, New Jersey is all of a sudden the bastion of, you know, of voting freedom. I mean, it's because there's a Democratic governor here. This is all about politics. That's all it's about. And you know it.
That's why I am saying I'm not going to a Major League Baseball game this summer. I'm not going to fly Delta unless I have to. I'm not going to drink Coca-Cola because they have become arms of the Democratic Party. Now, I don't know if Rob Manfred's a friend of yours. And
he is not. I know the commissioner, but I would not say he's a friend of mine. We've met.
Okay. It seems to me that the heads of those organizations all came up from the organizations, and they are all in insular environments. If they had called anybody, if they had done any kind of due diligence, if they'd read the Georgia Public Broadcasting analysis, hardly a bastion of segregationist thought in the United States, they would have realized it was a balanced law, nuanced, that had a tuck and a nip here. Instead, they just swallowed it whole cloth. Do they not have organizations in place to make sure they hear points of view?
You know, I don't know. And I don't know what they did in terms of making these decisions. But what I'll say is this. It is a symptom of what we're seeing in this country right now, Hugh, that's very, very dangerous. And the President Biden, you know, accused Donald Trump over and over again during the campaign and the transition of making things up, making up stories to divide the country. You and I both agreed at the time about, you know, voter fraud in the election and whether there was evidence of voter fraud that would have changed the results of the election. And we were willing to be critical of the president when he was doing things that we both felt were out of line. But, you know, Joe Biden is now doing the exact same thing he accused Donald Trump of doing. And when you have the president of the United States out there doing that, and at the same time, Hugh, threatening to raise corporate taxes significantly on these folks, you know that there are people out there who are wondering what he'll do next if they were to disagree with him. That doesn't make it right, but it makes the president the arsonist.
Byron York, chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner, saw reason for hope in all the turmoil as the debate raged over the new Georgia laws. He joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
The reason I thought it might get better, I thought we have little green shoots of reason coming up, is that I've seen a couple of discussions on the internet in which people discuss the Georgia bill rationally. People who have some objections to some provisions of it, who think other provisions of it are good and think other provisions of it are completely, totally overhyped and not as important as they're presented to be. So I thought, well, that's huge progress. Now, the problem is the president of the United States, Joe Biden, is leading the irrational forces here. And you have this atmosphere of corporate fear that has taken place, not just with what Major League Baseball did, but Delta, Coca-Cola, two companies in Georgia, tons of other companies feeling that they have to be woke and issue a statement. I mean, United Airlines issued a statement on the importance of voting yesterday, and I'm thinking, why? Why are they doing this? Who asked
them? May I read that for the benefit of our audience? United Airlines, 19 hours ago, put out this statement. Our mission is to connect people and unite the world. We believe that one of the most effective ways to do this is to engage in the democratic process, which begins with voting, a vital civic duty. America's democracy is stronger when we're all engaged and every vote is properly counted. Some have questioned the integrity of the nation's election systems and are using it to justify stricter voting procedures, even though numerous studies have found zero credible evidence of widespread fraud in U.S. elections. Legislation that infringes on the right to vote of fellow Americans is wrong. We believe that leaders in both parties should work to protect the right of eligible voters by making it easier and more convenient for them to cast a ballot and have it counted, which is what I think Georgia did. But my question is, what conceivable reason does United Airlines have to put this out? Their mission is to connect people and unite the world? No, their mission is to fly me from L.A. to D.C. And now I'm not going to get on United. I'm going to get on Alaska because I don't want to fly a Democratic airline.
Well, you're going to run out of airlines at some point because you do have now Delta and United. Has American Airlines made a statement? That's a real question. I don't know.
I don't know either.
But unite the world. Their mission is to unite the world.
Unite the world. What?
Crazy sounding?
It's so crazy. You know, anybody who got up on any television set in America and issued those words, my mission is to unite the world, you'd immediately start looking over at the stage manager and saying, let's get this guy off of here, right? You'd
be this guy's mic.
Yeah, cut this guy's mic. Our mission is to unite the world. Unite the world. Who's running United Airlines?
What you're saying is there's a weird malady of some sort running through corporate America.
Yes.
And it is fear. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that a lot of these executives, they don't believe this stuff. They are afraid of something, the woke mob, some sort of repercussions if they don't get on board right now. And that's what you're seeing operate. That's what President Biden is fueling. He is stoking that fear with what he said about the Georgia law, about the All-Star game. The question is, can corporate America get past its fear at some point and just stick to what they're doing? You know, shut up and fly.
Coming up, the Derek Chauvin trial.
The guy had no pulse and was not breathing for the last 4.5 minutes. And even a minute after the ambulance showed up, he kept his knee on the guy's neck.
The Town Hall Review continues in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over 2 decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The knee-jerk decision to move the All-Star Game has put a spotlight on voting laws nationwide. The new Georgia law is quite similar to those accepted in many states, including President Biden's home state of Delaware. Salem host Larry Elder examines how the voting public views these laws.
Can we start with the decision by Major League Baseball to move the All-Star Game out of Atlanta? Not quite sure where they're going to play it. Don't know whether or not that state's voting laws are more harsh or more liberal than Georgia's. But here's what Ilhan Omar said about the decision to move the All-Star Game out of Georgia.
We know that boycotts have allowed for justice to be delivered in many spaces. The civil rights movement was rooted in boycotts. We know that, you know, apartheid ended in South Africa because of boycotts. And so our hope is that, you know, this boycott will result in changes in the law, because we understand that when you restrict people's ability to vote, you create a democracy that isn't fully functioning for all of us. And if we are to continue to be a beacon of hope for all democracies around the world, we must stand our ground.
Unbelievable. Likening this to apartheid. There have been boycotts before that have succeeded. What does the Georgia voting bill actually say? The two most serious allegations are that the bill prevents people waiting in lines from getting water, and it shortens the amount of time that people have in Georgia to vote. To this, Representative Byron Donalds, Republican of Florida, said,
"The Democrats are race baiting. They are wrong. Look, I've reviewed the Georgia law myself. What Georgia's doing is the absolute right thing. I know the president's running around trying to tell people that you can't give somebody a cup of water, but that's not what Georgia law says. What Georgia law says is that you can't give people something of value when they're in lines getting ready to vote, because, you know, we don't want to buy off votes in America. That's like a sound concept. That's what we should be doing. The other thing that's happening in these voting lines, people are getting these voter cards when they're also getting something of value in the lines. And so the Georgia legislature is right to get rid of that provision in Georgia law and make sure that they can't do those things. That's simple stuff, John. This is not what they're trying to say. They're trying to race bait because they know they got the argument wrong and they don't have a leg to stand on, so they got to use race."
Here is what the Atlanta Journal-Constitution said about the key details of the election bill that was passed by Georgia legislature. Okay. "Absentee ballots would be verified based on driver's license numbers or other documentation instead of voter signatures." Sounds pretty racist to me. "Ballot drop boxes would only be allowed inside early voting locations and available strictly during business hours. Weekend voting would be expanded for general elections, with two mandatory Saturdays offered statewide. Counties could also choose to offer early voting on two optional Sundays." Trying to figure out the racist part here. "Members of the public would be prohibited from distributing food or water to voters waiting in line. Election workers, of course, would not be prohibited from doing that." I'm looking for the racism. Chris Christie, former governor of New York.
And so here he is, doing exactly what he accused President Trump of doing back during the campaign, and doing it in a way that is just brutally bad. I mean, even the Washington Post gave him four Pinocchios.
He's referring to Joe Biden.
For the statements that he made. The Washington Post guy. You can imagine how it pained them to have to do that to their hero, this Democratic president.
The whole point behind, quote, voter suppression, close quote, of course, is to prevent people of color from voting, right? Those dastardly Republicans, those racist Republicans don't want black people voting. That's what Joe Biden said to Al Sharpton. Republicans don't want black people voting, man. Remember that? Well, study by professors from Stanford, Yale says that, and Pennsylvania, said that when the errors are corrected based upon another study that was published and got widespread reaction claiming that these laws suppress the black vote. Follow-up study, according to researchers at Stanford, Yale, University of Pennsylvania, the original study was based upon surveys of voters that are extremely unreliable, skewing the results. Quote, "When the errors are corrected, the follow-up research has found there's no evidence in the analyzed data that voter laws have a statistically significant impact on voter turnout," end of quote. The data just don't show it. In other words, in English, the data do not support the notion that these laws are in any way, shape, or form suppressing the black vote. Moreover, riddle me this. If these voter suppression laws are suppressing the black vote, why do 69% of black voters support voter ID laws as opposed to 75% of the general public? And how is it that in 2008 and in 2012, for the first time in American history, the percentage of eligible black voters who voted exceeded the percentage of eligible white voters who voted, despite the alleged voter suppression laws? Can you explain that to me?
The tragic murder of George Floyd ignited protests across the country. And now the policeman accused of murdering Floyd stands trial. Andrew McCarthy has been covering the trial for National Review. He discussed the latest in the case while on Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560.
I've been reading your coverage of the Chauvin trial. And, you know, I think in the minds of most, it's a fait accompli. Maybe the only debate is whether it will be third or second degree murder, his conviction. But you have written at least one piece suggesting that some of the prosecution's witnesses have not lived up to their advanced billing in terms of helping the prosecutors the state's case, including that retired EMT who testified last week. What's your handle on what has transpired in that trial to date?
Well, I think it's very uphill for Chauvin, in part for the reasons that you've explained. You know, it all comes down to the jury, of course. So even though we think it's a fait accompli, the 12 people still have to decide it, and the prosecutor's got to get all of them. You know, if Chauvin plants doubt in the mind of one person, you end up getting a mistrial, which is always beneficial to the defense in the long run. But, you know, here's why I think it's uphill for Chauvin, and it should be. What the state's best evidence shows is that they kept him in a prone position on the street with Chauvin keeping his knee on the guy's neck for 9.5 minutes. That's what they keep telling the jury, 9-2-9. That's the most important thing, 9 minutes and 29 seconds. And they obviously want to concentrate on that because Floyd violently resisted arrest beforehand, and they don't want to talk about that. But the problem I think Chauvin's really going to have is that the guy had no pulse and was not breathing for the last 4.5 minutes. And even a minute after the ambulance showed up, he kept his knee on the guy's neck. And it doesn't look like there's any good reason for having done that. He wants to convince them that they were afraid that the guy would suddenly come to and get violent again. But when you have a guy who's not breathing and doesn't have a pulse and is handcuffed behind the back, their training, it looks like, is to turn him over on his side so that at least his airway passages are better open. And you try to treat him, especially if he's got no pulse, you know, they're trained to start compressions, and they didn't do any of that. So is it a criminal thing, or is it negligence, which is manslaughter? I think the last 4.5 minutes is very hard to show them.
Coming up, a 60 Minutes reporter's deceptive editing exposed.
I haven't seen something like it in a very long time.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over 2 decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. When the news magazine 60 Minutes debuted in 1968, there were just 3 major networks. No cable, no personal computers, no, of course, internet. For a decade, 60 Minutes was the dominant news magazine. Millions of Americans turned to the program for the best in investigative reporting. But that began to unravel in 2004 when Dan Rather fudged fact to disparage President George W. Bush's military record. Rather's career was over. Several others related to the program were fired. 60 Minutes is still broadcasting, though, and yet they have tarnished their image again with a fudged hit piece, this time on Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. The reporter carefully edited out DeSantis answering her exact question on an alleged pay-to-play deal with the Publix supermarket chain to make it appear as if the governor had no reasonable answer, when in fact he had killed it. John Solomon of Just the News joined Salem host Joe Piscopo on AM 970 The Answer out of New York City.
We reached out to you because I'm so confused when I saw what happened with with the 60 Minutes situation. The 60 Minutes situation with Ron DeSantis. How in the name of God do they go down there, nail him like that? And if it wasn't for folks like yourself, John Solomon, and just the news coming out and being honest, like I talk about all, every day on this radio show, Ron DeSantis would be guilty, according to a big television network. What the heck was going on there?
Yeah, well, it looks to be sloppy reporting because you have even Democrats down in Florida, the former or the current Palm Beach mayor. You've got the Publix grocery chain issuing very strong, irrefutable statements denying that the what was reported by 60 Minutes. The 60 Minutes tried to portray a vaccine deal with Ron DeSantis' administration as a pay-to-play. Both Publix, the target of it, and the mayor, who was involved right in the area, said it's just not true. And I think we have this era in American journalism of gotcha journalism where people want to take down whoever the top peg is, and DeSantis is getting credit for, you know, doing a good job on COVID, and so 60 Minutes comes in. But it's a rare moment to see 60 Minutes challenged so publicly and also by, like, such a wide range of sources that I think they have to reflect. I mean, I remember I was involved in this 20, 25 years ago when 60 Minutes had, they used to have a second show called 60 Minutes 2, and they made a false report about President Bush and his Air National Guard records. And we were the news organization that debunked that. I was at the Associated Press. I recognized the document was fake, and we did some reporting on it, and that led to the demise of 60 Minutes, too. And so there's been some history, 25 years apart. Normally 60 Minutes does important journalism, but this one here is really strongly being called into question. I haven't seen something like it in a very long time.
That's a great point you make, John. What happened with it was Dan Rather that made that
that
false report. You know, I was doing some research. We were talking about Frank Sinatra, and I studied an interview that Walter Cronkite did back in 1965. CBS, Walter Cronkite. That was the guy. That's right. The way it is, right? Right, John. You know the
right,
guy.
Exactly. He was the guy. Yeah, that's New was, World. You're right.
But he was a left wing guy. He was a liberal. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you would never know it watching the Frank Sinatra interview. It was like it was a brilliant interview. See, Andy Rooney wrote the piece. You know, Don Hewitt produced it, and no matter what they believed, they were still objective. Who from 60 Minutes sent this gal down to go after DeSantis, do you think, John?
You know, it's hard to know. And a lot of times reporters on the front lines, they get excited by their story. Someone calls them up and says, I've got something on DeSantis. And you start digging in. And, one of the great dangers of investigative reporting is tunnel vision. You've got to try to keep all eyes open, all your sources open, and challenge everything that's been given to you. And I think today, you know, the old adage of journalism, get it right, but first get it right. Today is get it first and hope it's right. And I think that position in the American media has led to so many embarrassing mistakes. And you can go back now and look at all the stories that were written about the Russia collusion scandal that are just, you know, irrefutably false now, overtly false. On the front page of the New York Times, on the front page of the Washington Post. And I think this mentality of just getting it first and hoping it's right is leading to a lot of bad journalism. There just aren't journalists today that have the patience to get through the process and make sure that something they're about to report is accurate. There's a little bit of arrogance when someone says we're the purveyor of truth. What we ought to be is the purveyor of neutral facts. We ought to just neutrally purvey the facts to people and let other people make up their mind. When you start getting to we're telling you the truth, you're getting into trying to make people's minds up. And I think there's a little bit of ivory tower arrogance when someone says, we're the news media who give you the truth. What we really should be doing, neutrally presenting the facts and let other people decide what is, you know, the truth, the reality, what they want to believe. And I think the American media spent too much time, particularly since the beginning of the Trump era, trying to make people's minds up for them instead of just giving them information. And I think we're all going to look back 10 years at this era of journalism and be very concerned about it.
Coming up, the Arkansas legislature said no more, and God bless them for that.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Earlier this week, Arkansas became the first state to pass legislation aimed at protecting youth from making decisions before adulthood that could result in permanent physical harm. But not before the bill titled Arkansas Saves Adolescents from Experimentation Act was vetoed by Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson. The very next day, both the Arkansas House and Senate voted to override the veto. Mark Davis looks at the bill and the actions of Hutchinson on 660 AM, The Answer, out of Dallas, Texas.
Now the issue is gender. The Arkansas legislature overwhelmingly passed a bill to draw a halt to the horrible abuse of children through chemical castration and puberty blockers and this nonsense of taking kids who think they're the wrong gender and going with that and chemically altering them and doing surgery and God knows what else. The Arkansas legislature said no more, and God bless them for that. And then Governor Asa Hutchinson vetoed the bill. There's a happy ending because the legislature overrode the veto, 71-24 in the House, 25-8 in the Senate. So Asa Hutchinson, bloodied by this defeat, decides, as I guess Kristi Noem did, hey, what a great idea. Let's go on Tucker Carlson. That'll go well for me. I'll let you be the judge. What you're about to hear, and this is important to chronicle all of this, because as 2024 draws near, as 2022 draws near, we're going to win back the House, maybe the Senate. We have to look for candidates, leaders, people to carry the message of conservatism who are as blemish-free as we can. Ain't nobody perfect, I know, but if you've got somebody with just a massive blind spot or a spine that will turn to jelly, ain't nobody got time for that. After Biden, after the Harris-Biden administration, we are going to have to be led by the most, pardon me, badass, constitutional, fearless conservatives we can find. We do not have time for foggy thinking. We do not have time for soft spines. We do not have time for people who will buckle and surrender to corporate wokeness or anything else. So Tucker asked Governor Hutchinson, why in the world did you veto this bill?
If this had been a bill that simply prohibited chemical castration, I would have signed the bill. But Tucker, as you know, this bill was overbroad, it was extreme, it went far beyond what you just said. And I made it clear that if this was about prohibiting procedures, sex reassignment surgery, absolutely, I would have signed that bill. But this, again, is the first law in the nation that invokes the state between medical decisions, parents who consent to that.
What?
And the decision of the patient.
What? The decision of the patient? The patient is 12. This is the language of radical pro-choicers. What are you doing getting between a woman and her doctor? Well, excuse me, we got a baby to save in there. What does this bill do? It was called the Save Adolescents from Experimentation Act. That's snappy. And it would have outlawed the surgery, would have also outlawed hormone therapy, and it would have brought this evil nonsense to a stop, even for people who are already receiving these treatments. It was exactly the right thing to do. Now, Governor Hutchinson again on why he didn't have the spine or the clarity to go with it.
So this goes way too far. And in fact, it doesn't even have a grandfather clause that those young people that are under hormonal treatments.
If you're under hormonal treatments to turn you from a boy to a girl, this is a child who needs rescue. Rescue.
If I can just correct you for a second. Well, this is chemical castration, of course. If you stop puberty and suppress the sex hormones, you're chemically castrating someone. So our description was correct. But let me just ask you, I mean, there are all kinds of, we're talking about minors, children here, and there are all kinds of things in Arkansas kids in every state are not allowed to do. Get married, drink a beer, get a tattoo. Why do you think it's important for conservatives to make certain that children can block their puberty, be chemically castrated? Why is that a conservative value, if you would tell us?
Well, first of all, you have parents involved in very difficult decisions. You have physicians that are involved in these decisions.
Some physicians are evil. Some physicians are stupid. Some physicians are quacks. Kids need to be protected from all of the above.
And I go back to William Buckley. I go back to Ronald Reagan.
Oh, sweet Lord. I'll tell you what, when you've got a squish and the vice of pressure is being placed on him, they're going to invoke Reagan. I want to, you know, they're going to talk about the love of their past icons, even as they erode their own conservatism and clarity right in front of your very eyes.
The principles of our party, which believes in a limited role of government.
Listen, by the way, as conservatives, we totally do believe in a limited role of government. Hey, let's make a list of things conservatives think it's okay for government to do. Stop a 12-year-old from drinking a beer, right? Stop a 13-year-old from driving a car. Stop people of many ages from having an abortion and killing a baby. There's a list of things, as conservatives, we want government to do. Stopping the chemical castration of children and the child abuse of transgender extremism is on that list. And for Asa Hutchins or anybody else to try to shade that or turn that into a gray area or convolute that using the trying to wrap himself in the honorable cloth of limited government, I'm sorry, it's indefensible.
We as a party abandoning a limited role of government and saying we're going to invoke the government decision making over and above physicians, over and above healthcare, over.
Yes, if those physicians are insane. Yes, if those parents are insane. Yes.
Above parents and saying you can't do that.
So you believe it's healthcare.
You cannot engage in that.
How deeply have you studied this topic? With respect, it doesn't sound like you've studied it very deeply.
Wow.
I mean, this is an emerging field. There's not a lot of research, but the research that exists suggests that depression and the urge to self-harm and suicide is a side effect of taking these hormones. A study in the UK showed the overwhelming majority of kids, of children on puberty-blocking hormones had the urge to hurt themselves. Why is that responsible medicine to do that to children? Why would you support something like that?
Well, I actually reviewed some of that study. I reviewed the high court decision there, and I think they are different than what you're talking about here. Sure, there's a lot of unknowns here. I studied this bill in contrast to what you just said. I spent a lot of time reviewing cases, meeting with people.
Meeting with people? What people?
Listening to the experts as well.
Experts? What experts?
To faith leaders as well. And I'm a person.
Yeah, I'd like to find the faith leader who thinks it's a great idea to chemically castrate a boy because an 11-year-old thinks he's a girl. Please find me that faith leader. Please. You know, is he maybe in the Senate? Is it Raphael Warnock? I mean, I'll tell you what, there are three categories of people where you can find dreadful, dreadful thinking. One of them is parents, one of them is doctors, and another one, sadly, is faith leaders. Some of them are full of it. Bottom line here is this is the reputational collapse of Asa Hutchinson.
To hear the entire Mark Davis monologue, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up, Charlie Kirk on The People in Power.
They've basically messed up everything.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return.
If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, they'll look at a new report at the treatment of Christians in China.
What they're doing is torture, and it's physical torture, mental torture.
And a First Amendment victory for a college professor.
Thankfully, the Sixth Circuit has decided in his favor on the grounds that First Amendment.
Albert Mueller looks at the collision we're witnessing between religious liberty and the fast-advancing agenda of the left.
It's the willingness to say it out loud that's going to get us in trouble.
And Jerry Boyer with a lesson on big tech and the social media companies.
If the service you're using is free, then you're not the customer. You're the product.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. With the pandemic came emergency powers, state by state. Governors, mayors, and other officials were granted control rarely seen in a free country such as ours. Some used that power minimally and with great restraint. Many others with an iron fist and a long timeline. Salem host Charlie Kirk discusses what we have learned.
If you want to see who a real leader is, give them a bunch of power and resources in a time of crisis and then judge them. And my goodness, have we learned a lot about our leadership in the last year. We've realized that we have very few courageous leaders in America, a especially on the gubernatorial level. Ron DeSantis is the best governor in America, period. Ron DeSantis was given a lot of power during this crisis. How did he fare? With an open state, a vibrant state, a happy state, economically vibrant state. How about Andrew Cuomo? Gave him a bunch of power. And isn't it interesting how Andrew Cuomo has just fallen out of the news cycle? Is he still under those accusations? Are we supposed to believe all women? No, the left, they learned their lesson after Al Franken. After Al Franken resigned due to the allegations, they said, wait a second, we didn't have to do this. No one actually cares what we do anymore. We're just going to distract them, and then we'll stay in power and people will forget. That's their playbook. Doesn't look like Andrew Cuomo's resigning anytime soon. Same with Eric Swalwell, and the list continues. So as we look back in 1 year of us giving more power to politicians, there's been more power vested in politicians than any other time in American history in the last year. How have we fared? They've basically messed up everything. You have a couple rare examples like Ron DeSantis, but most states are struggling to get back to normal. And that's because the compact that we have with the people in charge is supposed to be based in a consent of the governed. It's supposed to be based in this promise that we're not going to abuse your freedoms and liberties beyond what is articulated in the document that is rules for the road for us. And with the exceptions that I've already mentioned, most governors completely mess this up. So what's the lesson here? The lesson is that we should limit the amount of power that goes to central authorities, both government and otherwise. But power shows the man. You want to see who a person really is? You want to see if a politician is willing to do the right thing? Give him a bunch of power in a time of crisis. And we've realized this is why despotism is not just immoral, but it fails over time. Gavin Newsom under a recall effort. Andrew Cuomo near resignation because of accusations and the nursing home scandal. J.B. Pritzker, one of the worst governors in America. So a year later, I hope that we have now learned our lesson that we will never again cede our freedoms and liberties to a central governing authority.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. And sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producer Charlie Richards, David Pouchon, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, Harley Eide, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.